Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It's 6 a.m. in Beijing, 12 p.m. in Honolulu, and 6 p.m. here in New York. I'm Julia Chatterley, and wherever you are in the world, this is your first move. A warm welcome once again to First Move, and here's your need to know. Former special counsel Robert Ter defending his investigation of President Joe Biden's handling of classified documents. Haiti's prime minister resigns as the World Food Programme warns a million Haitians are on the brink of famine. Authorities launch an investigation into the dramatic mid-air drop of a LATAM Airlines flight on Monday. And so-called Sephora kids are a viral hit on TikTok for their skincare trends, but with children as young as eight taking part, is enough care being taken? All that and plenty more coming up on the show. But first, the U.S. prosecutor behind a report describing Joe Biden as a, quote, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory defended those words on Capitol Hill. Former special counsel Robert Ter, who investigated the president's handling of classified documents, came under fire from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. Republicans pressed him on his decision not to prosecute the president. Democrats, meanwhile, criticized Ter for his comments on President Biden's memory while directly comparing his conduct with Donald Trump's own mishandling of secret files. Paula Reed has the highlights from Tuesday's testimony.
Do you swear or affirm under
former special counsel Robert Ter, grilled by lawmakers from both sides of the aisle today about his investigation into President Biden's mishandling of classified documents.
Mr. Ter, why'd he do it? Why did Joe Biden, in your words, willfully retain and disclose classified materials? I mean, he knew the law. Been in office like 50 years.
You exonerated
a conviction.
I know that the term willful retention has a... Mr. Ter, it's my time.
Biden's memory took center stage, as Ter said in his report, that he did not charge Biden because he believed a jury would see him as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory.
You find in your report that the elements of a federal criminal violation are met, but then you apply this senile cooperator theory that because Joe Biden cooperated and the elevator doesn't go to the top floor, you get a conviction.
You understood when you made that decision, didn't you, Mr. Ter, that you would ignite a political firestorm with that language, didn't you?
Congressman, politics played no part whatsoever in my investigative steps.
You cannot tell me you're so naive as to think your words would not have created a political firestorm. You understood that.
Ter told the committee he stood by the words in his report.
My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair.
He was also pressed on the differences between Biden's case and that of former President Trump, those being that Biden returned the documents. He allowed for searches of various properties and even sat for a voluntary interview with the special counsel.
Did you find that President Biden engaged in a conspiracy to obstruct justice?
No.
Did you find that President Biden engaged in a scheme to conceal?
No.
Ter repeatedly made it clear he did not exonerate the president.
Mr. Ter, did you completely exonerate President Biden?
That is not what my report does.
Ter also emphasized that he was making a legal conclusion about Biden's mental state, not a medical one.
Mr. Ter, based on your report, did you find that the president was senile?
I did not. That conclusion does not appear in my report.
And legal analyst Carrie Cordero joins us now. Carrie, I think it was made very clear there by Paula, this hearing was stretched to include all sorts of questions about the handling of this versus Trump's own challenges over mishandling documents and the political motive that the Democrats suggested was behind the characterization of Biden's memory and brain function, I think. But can we focus on what Hurst said ultimately about the president? He chose not to file charges, but he did not exonerate him. I did not exonerate him. For what it's worth, there was irresponsible handling of documents here.
Yeah, so I think Special Counsel Herr really conducted himself professionally today in a nonpartisan way that tended to make unhappy the partisans in the room who were interrogating him. But he stood by the findings in his report. And ultimately, as a prosecutor, he had to make a recommendation as to whether or not he thought a jury would be convinced of the president's potential violations of law, and he found that they would not. And a prosecutor working under the guidelines of the Justice Department cannot bring a case, cannot charge a case, unless they think that they reasonably would persuade a jury that they would succeed at trial. And so what he articulated based on the extensive facts contained and the analysis contained in his report, which was over 350 pages, he ultimately determined that that case, if he were to bring it, would not have been successful.
Yes, and I think you could also argue when you're being criticized heavily by both sides, perhaps your independence in that case or your lack of bias becomes even more clear. Was a clear distinction made inadvertently? Because, of course, Herr wasn't involved in the investigation of President Trump's or former President Trump's activities with regarding mishandled documents. But was a clear distinction made in your mind between what happened with President Trump's handling of these classified documents and what President Biden did and didn't do?
Absolutely. I think there's very clear distinctions if one looks at the charging documents in each of the individual cases. I actually don't think that Special Counsel Herr needed to make that distinction in his own report, since he, as a prosecutor, did not evaluate all of the facts in the Trump investigation. But one of the big distinguishing characteristics of the two cases is that when the government brought to the awareness of former President Trump that he was believed to retain classified documents, he refused to return them. He did not sit for an interview. He did not cooperate with the investigation. And so ultimately, that's why he was charged with obstruction. In the case of President Biden, there was a much longer time period over which the retention of classified information at various locations was involved. But once he was alerted and his counsel was alerted to the investigation and to the concerns of the government, he cooperated, his legal counsel cooperated, they returned documents, he sat for an interview, he cooperated in every possible way. And those are really the main distinguishing facts between the investigations.
Yeah, and to your point, Herr didn't have to point that out either in this report or today, but actually the Democrats, I think, at least personally, were quite successful in pointing out the difference. To my point about how this hearing got stretched, Herr was also pushed on his assessment of President Biden's memory and his decision to talk about the president's mental acuity in this report and as part of a justification for not bringing charges as a result. He described his assessment of Biden's memory as necessary, accurate and fair. Would you agree or did you think he went too far? Because we didn't get more from this hearing, but one could argue that he went far enough.
Right. Well, I think that from my perspective, I take him at his word that he believed it was necessary and appropriate that he include that information in his report, which is the report is produced under regulations, Justice Department regulations that govern how special counsels work. I do think it calls into question the special counsel regulations as they exist, because the report that the regulations call for is supposed to be a confidential report. That's not really the way that it works in practice. In this case and in others, those reports end up being released publicly as this one was. His report also is very, very extensive. It has chapters. And I think that goes beyond what a typical prosecutorial memo, particularly one that's declining a prosecution, would do. I don't fault him for that, but I do think that it raises the question of whether the regulations themselves need to be streamlined and tailored and more narrow so that a future special counsel has more guidance about what should and should not go into their report.
That's a great point, because very few people are going to read the report ultimately, and snapshots and quotes of that can be taken out of context and used accordingly. So that's a very important point, I think. Carrie Cordero, thank you so much for your wisdom.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Now, this all comes as voters in Georgia, Hawaii, Mississippi and Washington state cast their votes in primary contests, potentially confirming what we already expect, a Biden-Trump rematch in November. In around 20 minutes' time, we'll have more on Super Tuesday Mark II with my guest, Republican strategist Doug High. For now, though, we'll move on to Haiti, where the World Food Programme is warning that 1 million people are a step away from famine as gang violence rips through the capital. The UN says gangs now control 80% of Port-au-Prince. A transitional council is being set up by Caribbean leaders now that Haiti's prime minister has announced his resignation. But the country's most notorious gang leader says he will not recognize any government put in place by that council. Patrick Ottman is on the story for us, monitoring from Havana in Cuba. Patrick, good to have you with us. We're now at a point where gang leaders, such as this individual, are holding press conferences. And I think, at least to some, they're perceived to be in some way part of the sort of future stakeholders in any of these negotiations. Do they have to be part of some council for it to succeed?
They are certainly holding the power right now at the point of a gun. The U.S. has said that they will not allow gang members, people who have been involved with drug trafficking in the past, like some of these individuals, to be involved in the transitional council. But they are the ones who have kept Ariel Henry, the former, the outgoing prime minister, from returning to the country. He was under intense pressure to resign. But now that he's done so, it's not clear if that is going to move Haiti any closer to a solution to its ongoing crisis. For more than a week, Haiti's marauding gangs prevented Prime Minister Ariel Henry from returning to the country he was supposed to lead. Until finally, Henry reached a breaking point and agreed on Monday night to resign.
My government will leave immediately after the inauguration of the council. We will be a caretaker government until they name a prime minister and a new cabinet. Haiti needs peace. Haiti needs stability.
Henry had traveled from Haiti to Kenya to sign an agreement with the government there to provide troops to fight the out-of-control gangs terrorizing his beleaguered nation. Once he left, the gangs united to further batter the Haitian government in a series of coordinated attacks. The latest explosion of violence leading to a massive jailbreak that freed thousands of prisoners, closed the country's main airport indefinitely, and forced the United States and other embassies to evacuate diplomats by helicopter. The news of Henri's impending resignation is not placating the leaders of gangs, though, who have threatened an all-out civil war.
We in Vivasan are demanding that the Haitian people must choose the person who will lead the country.
But it is the Haitian people who are suffering the most. More than 300,000 have been displaced by the violence, the UN says. Gangs block access to food, water, and hospitals, using hunger and sexual violence as weapons of war. Bodies of their victims lie uncollected on streets. On Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with regional leaders in Jamaica and announced an increase in U.S. funding to the security mission to be led by Kenyan troops.
I'm announcing today that the United States Department of Defense is doubling its approved support for the mission from $100 million to $200 million. And that brings the total U.S. support to $300 million for this effort.
Following the announcement that Henry will resign, Kenyan officials now saying a government needs to be in place in Haiti before their troops can deploy, creating more doubt of when exactly they will have boots on the ground to begin fighting the heavily armed local gangs. For too many Haitians living in a country where there is no longer a functioning government, no escape from the violence, it is already too late.
So it really has become something of a catch-22 here, that there has to be a government for the Kenyan troops to arrive, and yet Ariel Henry very clearly is not able to come back to his own country, is not in charge of anything anymore, and so partners around the region, the United States and others, felt that it was best for him to leave. But how do you regain security? How do you take back the streets from these gangs who very, very clearly want to keep the chaotic situation the way it is, because it is quite simply good for the business, good for cocaine trafficking, good for their extortion business, good for kidnapping. And at this point, they've essentially kidnapped an entire country.
Yes, and won't necessarily acknowledge a council that's formed. Deeply troubling. Patrick, thank you for that report. To Israel now, confirming the loss of a US-Israeli dual citizen. Itai Hen was one of six Americans still thought to be held alive in Gaza by Hamas. But the IDF says he died during the October 7th attacks. Meanwhile, new aid supplies have been airdropped into northern Gaza. The US Central Command says the drop on Tuesday was a joint operation with the Jordanian military, and more than 5,200 pounds of aid were delivered. Now, in addition to the airdrops, an aid ship is now sailing towards Gaza. Nada Bashir has more.
On its way at last, the Open Arms, normally a search and rescue vessel, setting sail from Larnaca in Cyprus, with nearly 200 tons of aid in tow, rice, flour, and canned goods, enough for 500,000 meals, according to World Central Kitchen.
It's the first time happening in many years, and that means that we are working with different actors, different governments, different entities to make this possible.
And this is where it's going, a makeshift pier in Gaza still under construction. This in addition to a temporary pier to be established by the US military on Gaza's coast. World Central Kitchen says it plans to distribute the food in Gaza, where a quarter of Palestinians are on the brink of famine, according to the UN.
My strongest appeal today is to honor the spirit of Ramadan by silencing the guns and removing all obstacles to ensure the delivery of life-saving aid at the speed and massive scale required.
Any form of celebration during this holy month is, at best, muted, with little food for Palestinians to break their fast at sunset. We decided to come and break our fast here in our home, which was struck. Despite the destruction and the rubble, we brought our food and cooked on firewood. Open Arms will be one of the first ships to enter the strip in years, ever since Israel implemented a naval blockade on the territory in 2007. Aid trucks, which, on average, crossed at around 500 a day before the war began, now pile up at the Rafah border crossing in Egypt. Only a fraction actually make it across the border every day. Governments and other aid agencies have also taken to airdrops, though this option has proven both controversial and even risky. Leaving the sea as one of the last remaining avenues to bring food to those so desperately in need. Nada Bashir, CNN, London.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but coming up, your up-to-the-minute weather forecast straight ahead, plus dozens injured, some pinned to the ceiling during the latest terrifying mishap to take place aboard a Boeing jet. The latest on what went wrong and how Boeing is addressing its worsening safety crisis. Next.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm a health reporter and have been for 15 years. And even I feel overwhelmed by some of the things I read about the stuff we're eating.
My colleague Meg Terrell wanted to take a deep dive into something you've probably heard a lot about recently. Ultra-processed foods. There is a lot to learn there, some fascinating stuff. And some of it is probably going to change the way you shop. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Move, and to our viewers across the US and Latin America, we hope you're having a wonderful Tuesday evening, and it's a good morning to everyone waking up with us in Asia. In today's Money Move, US stocks roaring back into rally mode Tuesday. Tech was triumphant, propelling the S&P 500 to a fresh record high. Following strong earnings from software giant Oracle, AI chip giant Nvidia also rallying 7%. All this after a mixed reading on US consumer inflation, food and housing prices eased, but core prices came in hotter than expected for a second straight month. And that sent bond yields higher and further complicates the Fed's future rate cutting path. Meanwhile, in Asia, a tepid Tuesday for the Japanese Nikkei, but nice gains for the Hang Seng. Shares of smartphone firm Xiaomi spiking more than 11% after announcing that its first electric car will go on sale later this month, helping send the Hang Seng Tech Index to three-month highs. Meanwhile, aerospace giant Boeing has suffered a further blow to its already battered reputation after a terrifying incident aboard a 787 jet traveling from Australia to New Zealand. Dozens of passengers were injured after the pilot apparently briefly lost control of the plane. This is just the latest in a growing series of safety incidents aboard Boeing jets this year, beginning, if you remember, back in early January when a door plug blew out on an Alaska Air 737 MAX shortly after takeoff. Well, a new FAA report now finding multiple problems with Boeing's 737 production practices after a six-week audit. Pete Montine reports on a further challenging period for Boeing.
New images show the aftermath of Monday's mysterious in-flight jolt on a Chilean Boeing 787. LATAM Airlines says a technical event caused a strong movement on board, injuring 50 passengers who peppered the pilots with questions.
I immediately engaged with him and said, you know, what was that? And he openly admitted, he said, I lost control of the plane. My gauges just kind of went blank on me. And that's when the plane just took a dive.
Boeing says it is standing by to help investigate the incident, the latest involving a Boeing plane. Following the Alaska Airlines door plug blowout in January, a wheel falling off a United flight last week, and hydraulic fluid trailing from another United flight during takeoff from Sydney this week.
People are pretty wary of Boeing right now, and when anything happens on a Boeing, people want to know.
Though there is no clear link between each incident, Boeing remains under the microscope of federal investigators. The Federal Aviation Administration now says it has completed its review of the 737 production line, with the New York Times reporting Boeing failed 33 of 89 quality control audits.
It wasn't just paperwork issues. Sometimes it's order that work is done. Sometimes it's tool management. It sounds kind of pedestrian, but it's really important in a factory that you have a way of tracking your tools effectively so that you have the right tool and that you know you didn't leave it behind.
FAA scrutiny follows anger from the National Transportation Safety Board, which blasted Boeing on Capitol Hill last week for failing to provide records that detailed the omission of key bolts from the Alaska Airlines plane. Boeing says those records do not exist.
We don't have the records. We don't have the names of the 25 people that is in charge of doing that work in that facility. It's absurd that 2 months later, we don't have that.
And Pete Montine joins us now. Pete, the issues are stacking up. It's pretty astonishing, to be honest. And if we go to this door plug incident, I know you're now reporting that the National Transportation Safety Board is going to convene a hearing on it. How rare is this?
Very rare. The last time they did this was for the East Palestine rail disaster. This will be on the door plug incident, and it means that Boeing officials could be subpoenaed to testify publicly. Boeing has not indicated how it will respond, but it is answering to the findings from the FAA's audit. A new Boeing memo underscores that workers must precisely follow every step when building their airplanes. The pressure is on from the top of Boeing all the way to the workers on the production line. Julia?
Yeah, certainly. And I think for consumers as well, another headline with Boeing in it. Pete Muntean, good to have you. Thank you very much for that. Okay, let's move on to today's weather move. A hint of spring in Beijing and other areas across Asia, but parts of the western U.S. still firmly in winter's grip, with heavy snow in the forecast for the Rockies. Chad Myers joins us from the CNN Weather Center. Chad, great to have you with us. Please, let's talk about spring first. We're ready for spring to spring. Sprung. Yes.
20 degrees Celsius in Beijing. I mean, that's 70. That's as close to spring as you really need. And the normal high should be 12, which is, you know, down into the upper 50s. So that's a big, big difference from where we are compared to where we should be. It'll still be a little snowy across the western prefectures here of Japan, but Tokyo still, you're going to be around 11. So no problem there. That's still already in the 50s. It will cool down just a touch for Beijing, also for Shanghai as well. But you're so far above normal that even really, 17 is going to feel pretty good compared to where you should be, somewhere around 12. Now we focus on the U.S. because typically we don't do this, but there are three big stories in the U.S. right now for tomorrow. A fire danger. Weather Service saying there is a potential firestorm danger in parts of Texas. Snow for the Rockies and severe weather through the plains, all from the same storm. But this extreme fire danger, winds 50 miles per hour, that's 70K. Then we have very dry air and very dry ground, and a place that's already burned. Over 1 million acres have already burned in parts of Texas. That's 445,000 hectares. So yes, we are already on fire in some of these places, and more wind will not help. There you see, 40 to 50 miles per hour, 70 kph. Now we get to the Rockies, where somewhere between 4 and an awful lot more, depending on your elevation, will fall in Colorado for tomorrow night and into Thursday. And there are places that are in the mountains that will pick up more than a half a meter. More than 24 inches of snow will be falling with this. And you know what? This is some place where people just want to go play in it. The problem is getting there. Can you get there when there's that much snow on the ground to go play in it or not? Because it will be significant from east of Denver, probably 10 centimeters, 4 inches, maybe even less. But then west of Denver in those higher elevations, you give it about 2,000 meters, 6,000, 7,000 feet, it is going to be a snowstorm. On the warm side, more to talk about, the potential for tornadoes for Wednesday and for Thursday in the Central Plains, all from the same low that's coming out of the west, as you talked about, Julia.
Wow, dramatic. Can't help talk about the snow, though. If you're going to play out in the snow, play safe, please.
That's right.
Chad Myers.
Take pictures for us, but take safe
exactly.
pictures.
Yes. Chad Myers, thank you. Okay, coming up after the break, Super Tuesday, the sequel. Voters in four states are expected to seal November's election battle. It's Trump versus Biden once again. That's next. Welcome back to First Move with a look at more of the international headlines this hour. Russian opposition activist Leonid Volkov is now in the hospital, according to the spokeswoman for Alexei Navalny's anti-corruption foundation. She says Volkov was attacked Tuesday outside his house in Vilnius, Lithuania. She also claims someone broke a car window and sprayed tear gas in his eyes, after which the attacker started hitting him with a hammer. Lithuanian authorities are investigating. Prosecutors in the U.S. state of Michigan have shown a jury the arrest video of parents of a high school mass shooter. Police say the couple fled before an arraignment involving the 2021 shooting attack that led to the deaths of four students. The father is currently on trial for involuntary manslaughter. The prosecution is expected to rest its case on Wednesday. A Romanian Court of Appeals has approved a request from Britain to extradite internet personality Andrew Tate, but postponed doing so until Romanian trial proceedings finish. However, Tate and his brother have been released from custody after being detained for 24 hours. The Tates have, quote, categorically rejected allegations of sexual aggression. Now, today's the day we could confirm what everyone already knew, and that is that President Biden will face former President Donald Trump at the polls in November. Well, that's being decided right now in these four states holding what's called primary elections. Under the pretty complicated system for political parties to pick their nominees, states assign the number of delegate candidates need to win the official nomination. Joe Biden's looking for 1,968 delegates. Donald Trump needs 1,215. Doug High is a Republican strategist and a former communications director for the Republican National Committee, and he joins us now. Doug, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Not that we needed the delegates to prove it, but it does look like it's going to be a 2020 reboot, hopefully with a lot less drama. But it's also historic, in rematch terms at least.
It is. It's something that, by and large, is unprecedented. And unprecedented not just because we don't typically see two nominees of the same party renominated 4 years in a row. I think the last time was in 1956 when Adlai Stevenson, the Democrat, challenged Dwight Eisenhower, who beat him in 1952, but also unprecedented in part because this is very early in the system. And so where really no one knows, I've talked to a lot of colleagues over the past couple weeks of what can we expect over the coming weeks and the coming months. And there's an expectation that there might be, to some extent, a lull in political activity because we know who the nominees are, and we're nowhere really near what we would normally consider the kickoff of the general election. So we may be, obviously Donald Trump's going to have a lot of court cases and controversy, but in pure political terms and campaigning, we may have a quiet spring for the next few weeks.
You raise a good point. For the next 4 to 5 months, Trump is going to be making numerous court appearances. Does that mean, in terms of President Biden's campaign, perhaps he has to do less too, which, again, has parallels or similarities to what we saw in 2020 and arguably benefits him?
Well, I'd argue that the president should be out there whenever he has good news to talk about. And I've been surprised that he hasn't been. So when we had the jobs numbers that came out last month, they were the best jobs numbers I think anybody's seen in a long time, not just with the current numbers, but previous month revisions. What we didn't see is the president then out talking about it. He didn't do an interview for Super Bowl Sunday, for instance. He wasn't out there then on Monday, Tuesday, making the case to the American people of why the economy is improving and why he thinks his policies are responsible for that. I think that's always a safe place for the president to be. He has a lot of good economic news that he could talk about. He just doesn't seem to do it very often.
Being president is an endurance test. Being on the campaign trail and being president is an almighty endurance quest. And I think perhaps in some ways this does tie to what we heard today with the hearing and the special counsel, Robert Hur. I mean, he came under fire from both sides for various reasons. But at the core of this, I think, for the Democrats, perhaps relief that we didn't hear more about some of the concerns that were raised in that initial report, which was about the president's mental acuity and whether or not perhaps he's got the brains and that the potential to survive not only the campaign, I think, and the winning the presidency, but what the next 4 years brings. Does that perhaps tie to it? And Doug, what did you take away from the hearing today, if anything?
Well, that ties into it. But I think the hearing today might have been more impactful against the president had it come a week or 2 weeks ago. It really follows on the heels of what was a successful speech in the State of the Union for the president. And that's not that one speech resets everything and changes the narrative or changes voters' opinions, but it should be the start of something. The challenge for Biden is that he needs to keep doing it over and over again. And ultimately, the problem that the president has, it's also a problem that Donald Trump has. So I think the real endurance test here is ultimately for the voters. Poll after poll shows that this is a sequel that they do not want to see and will be forced to. And this, what we see is Joe Biden's unpopular, Donald Trump's unpopular. Voters don't want this, and they're viewing this election as the movable object versus the resistible force. And it may not be a question of ultimately who does enough to win, but who does the least to lose.
Yeah, and does that involve getting out there and talking about the good news more, which I think is your advice and my strongest takeaway. Doug, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, CNN will have live coverage as results come in from around the country. It's Super Tuesday Mark II. Special coverage starts in around 20 minutes. That's 7 o'clock here in New York or 7 a.m. in Singapore. Now, the Biden administration announcing a new military aid package for Ukraine. It's worth up to $300 million. Officials say it became available due to savings in weapons contracts. It does, of course, come at a critical time with Ukraine running dangerously low on munitions and a bill for $60 billion worth of aid stalling in Congress. President Biden called on lawmakers to reach a consensus.
Congress must pass the bipartisan national security bill now, which includes urgent funding for Ukraine. We must act before it literally is too late, before it's too late. Because as Paul remembers, Russia won't stop at Ukraine. Putin will keep going, putting Europe, the United States, and the entire free world at risk, in my view.
Oren Lieberman joins us now from the Pentagon. I think the difference there was made very cleanly with a $60 billion aid package stalled. Clearly not all for Ukraine, but $300 million is something, but it feels more symbolic than anything.
It was, you know, at its very best, it is a stopgap measure. And the White House made that clear. Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, said this could last Ukraine a matter of weeks, perhaps as little as a couple of weeks. And then you're back to the concerns about, does Ukraine run out of ammunition? This package does have some of what they critically need, 155mm artillery ammunition, ammunition for the HIMARS rocket system, as well as anti-aircraft missiles to shoot down the Russian aerial assaults. But this isn't an endless supply, very far from it. It is a very small supply, and the Pentagon was only able to do this because of realized savings in the numbers of contracts they've given to weapons manufacturers. They essentially were able to negotiate better rates, and that gave them $300 million they were able to use. It's worth noting this is the first package from the Pentagon since last year, since December 27th, and even that was a relatively small package. So the U.S. is very much looking to get that supplemental through here. The question, of course, is what does that timeline look like? $90 billion in total with $60 billion for Ukraine. It's through the Senate. It is held up in the House. It has bipartisan support, but it still has to get to the floor, which hasn't happened yet. And that is what the White House was pushing for. That is what the Pentagon is pushing for, because they are fully aware of how critical the situation is at this point, Julia.
Yeah, Biden made that clear once again today. Oren Lieberman, thank you. Okay, we're going to take a break, but coming up next, paying an unimaginable price for a gourmet product. How the harvesting of acai berries in the Amazon is putting children at enormous risk.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Move. It's a superfood you might find in high-end grocery stores or juice bars. The acai berry, said to benefit everything from heart health to the effects of aging. But the story of how the fruit is harvested might leave you with a horrid taste in your mouth. As part of CNN's Freedom Project, Julia Vargas Jones ventured into the Amazon rainforest, where young children are risking their lives just to be able to make a living.
It's the middle of the night on the banks of the Amazon River. But the young workers of the Fazendinha village are already loading up for a day's work. They don't bring much, machetes, tarp bags, and a dry change of clothes. But first, their small boat needs to cross this massive river. Inside, the smell of diesel is nauseating. But Lucas, at 13 years old, is still waking up. On top of school, he says he's been picking acai for 2 years now, helping his older brother, Wengelson, feed their seven siblings. By dawn, we reach the Marajó archipelago in the far north of Brazil, crossing state lines to Pará, the world capital of acai. Amidst this lush vegetation are hundreds and hundreds of acai trees. These are these tall palms that can get up to 70 feet tall. Right now, these guys are looking closely to see which ones are ripe and have fruit ready for the picking.
In Brazilian culture, açaí has been called the guardian of the Amazonian population. Those who can harvest it, they say, will never go hungry. And 90% of the superfruit comes from this northern state. From 2012 to 2022, açaí exports grew 21,000%, according to industry data. More than 8,000 tons were exported in 2022, moving more than $26 million. But Lucas will only get a fraction of that number. And to earn it, he will do grueling work and face the dangers of the jungle. Hiding in the forest are deadly snakes, scorpions, and jaguars. And then there's the climb. With no harness, Lucas will climb dozens of açaí trees on a single day in search of ripe berries.
He makes this look easy, but actually these are quite heavy. Each one of these is about 10 pounds. These are dense fruit, and he comes down with two, sometimes three, or even four of these bushels just sliding down the tree.
In these remote areas of the jungle, rescue can be hours away. The stories of harvesters who've fallen from trees are numerous. Some have never walked again, or worse.
When was the first time you got up on an açaí tree?
He was 11 years old, he says. The money he makes, he says, he gives to his mom, who in turn gives him back a smaller portion. What do you use your money for, I ask. To buy my school supplies, he said. Families are risking their children's lives to get a paycheck, community leader Nerivan Silva says.
It's out of need and not having food on the table. This practice is inherited, passed down from father to son, but it's too dangerous. At the same time, it's our tradition that we've been doing for more than 100 years.
So it seems to me like there is a clash between both the tradition of the community and the education of the children.
There is, he says, but it doesn't have to be this way. The cycle of child labor here can be broken, he says, but they need help, incentives to get children to stay in school. Alain Bruno is a prosecutor investigating individual complaints of forced labor across the region. One of the biggest challenges, he says, is educating workers and children of their rights.
This is a reality of the rural work.
Some of them can't read, write, or even count. Their needs are so basic, it's almost unfathomable.
Come see the culture where the açaí comes from, because more often than not, people have no idea how much work it is for us to get it to your table.
Julia Vargas Jones, CNN, Marajó Islands, Brazil.
And be sure to join us this coming Thursday for My Freedom Day, a day-long student-driven event to raise awareness of modern-day slavery. Stay with CNN. We'll be back after this. Welcome back. Do you have a Sephora kid? In English, this is a younger child or a tween obsessed with pricey skincare products that they can buy at the beauty supply stores like Sephora, among other places. It's very trendy on TikTok. But as Vanessa Yurkevich explains, many of the products are not age appropriate for these young shoppers.
I have this and this. I have these two. Do you want to know what's my favorite chapstick?
Ruby Hale is obsessed with skincare.
That's pretty on you.
Mom Monique, a salon owner, now is too.
I used to collect Pogs when I was 9 years old, and Ruby likes to collect skincare. What if it's Pogs? Mine or somebody else's. What's Pogs? Something from a long time ago. Maybe Pogs will start trending again and we won't have to worry about skincare anymore.
Oh no, I would never forget skincare.
See, it's already in her DNA, I think.
I think it's because of TikTok.
Ruby is Gen Alpha, social media-obsessed tweens who watch Kardashian kids like Northwest and Penelope Disick showing off their skincare routines and their latest Sephora finds.
They're everywhere. Who's not a Sephora kid these days, it seems?
Tweens and teens spent more on skincare last year than any other demo, accounting for $4.7 billion in sales.
A Sephora kid was coined through social media as a skin-obsessed, for better of a lack of a better word, child. Who hasn't even started to age, who's obsessed with everything skincare.
that is not appropriate necessarily for their age group or their skin's issues or their skin type.
Why is that potentially harmful to children that age?
Do they need to be using anything that has anti-aging in the marketing? No, because they haven't even started aging. Retinols can be extremely irritating, extremely harsh, and is way too harsh for any 8 or 9 year old. Exfoliating acids, when you elicit an inflammatory response at such a young age, you're likely to also develop an allergy, a hypersensitivity. And at that point, there's no turning back.
I'm excited to go to Sephora, Mama.
I'm so excited for you. We're only doing 2 lip glosses and 1 perfume, and that is it.
Skincare craze Gen Alpha are flocking to Sephora and Ulta Beauty. Ulta says it has dermatologist-recommended skincare info for tweens both in-store and online. Sephora did not respond to CNN. But for Gen Alpha, what they see on social media is really hard to resist.
Absolutely not. What did we talk about with skincare?
I'm constantly talking to her about the peptides and the retinols and all that stuff that she doesn't need until her later 20s.
Do you use this one?
No, not really.
Why don't you use it?
Because I am too beautiful for it.
That is right, my love. You don't need a polypeptide cream.
Who is the onus on to educate these young girls? The parents, the brands, the stores.
The first barrier to entry is going to be through the parents. It's on the brands, it's also on the retailers, and it's on the content creators to have some sort of moral compass when they're talking about products.
Ruby loves those skincare videos, and people love watching Ruby's trips to Sephora. They get millions of views.
She is a Sephora kid. As a society, we need to accept where these 9 and 10 year olds are, and we've gotten a lot of criticism. Those comments are worse than going to Sephora and putting a bad skincare on your face, because that's affecting our kids today.
Wow. I think at 9 I was playing with Lego and My Little Pony. Parents, police your kids on social media. And finally, on First Move, a mind-boggling reminder that there's still so much we don't know about wonders of our planet. Marine researchers have announced that they've discovered about 100 potential new deep-sea creatures while on a mission off the coast of New Zealand, including this elusive deep-sea squid and 2 mystery critters that look a little like starfish. Well, kind of flowers. Scientists say they have no idea what this species family come from. The team also finding mystery mollusks, fish and coral that they believe have never been recorded before. More than 2 million different species are believed to live in the Earth's oceans, but only a fraction have been identified by scientists so far. I, for one, cannot wait to find out what new discoveries lie in the deep. Now, a reminder before we go that polls close in the US states of Georgia in around 4 minutes' time, and that will kick off our special coverage of the presidential primaries. We should soon see Donald Trump and President Joe Biden secure enough delegates for their respective parties' nominations. And that just about wraps up the show. Thank you for joining us, and I'll see you tomorrow.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.